Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival. This is Coast to Coast. I'm Carol Masser. We are here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance and the most interesting stories in global technology from Silicon Valley and beyond, powered by our more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. You can download Coast to Coast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern only on Bloomberg Radio.
It has certainly been life in the fast lane in a whole new way for Tesla and its founder and creator, Elon Musk. What a few days of headlines, and helping us make sense of it all along the way has been Max Chafkin. He is, of course, features editor over at Bloomberg Business Week, our frequent voice of sanity in all of this, joining us in our Bloomberg 1130 studio here in Manhattan. So, Max, bring us up to date. Some headlines over the weekend.
Yeah. So Elon Musk this morning, as we just heard, published a blog post trying to explain this line, funding secured, which had been at the core of a lot of the controversy, because it kind of sounded like he had secured the funding. And as the blog post kind of made clear, that the answer is no. As Bloomberg reported over the weekend, Elon Musk has had some discussions with the Saudi Arabia Public Investment Fund, and so it looks like they are a potential buyer here. We don't know how many shareholders would sell. We don't know what the price would be. We really don't know much, but we have a tiny bit more clarity than we had before.
And my big question, of course, was the headline that came out that Musk said this will not be a traditional LBO structure. There's going to be more equity and less debt. And that was something we were really all debating last week, is what type of go private deal would this look like? Seems like we got a little bit more clarity. He does not want an LBO.
Yeah, well, you can't really have an LBO if the company is losing tons of money, which
there's nothing to L.
Right, which is what's been happening. I think the way to think about this, if you want to try to see it from the Elon Musk point of view, is, you know, Uber. So Uber is a high potential company that's in the automotive industry with a high valuation. I think that's how Elon Musk sees Tesla. He doesn't think this is a maturing car company. He thinks this is a company with a successful car that's about to take over the entire auto industry, the entire energy industry, that's going to be worth way more one day than it is today. And that would be the kind of reason that you as a shareholder would be willing to do this. Because shareholders, if they go along with this plan, if they allow their shares to go from being, you know, shares in a public company to a private one, they're going to lose lots of rights and they're not going to be able to sell. They're going to be locked up. It's going to be like their Uber shareholders.
So, Max, we're going to hear later on from our colleague Ben Bain, who's going to tell us a little bit about how busy the SEC office out there is in San Francisco, owing to some folks other than Tesla. But specifically, the SEC is still going to be looking into what he said, when he said it, and what he meant, right?
Absolutely. I mean, even when these things happen in kind of a more orderly way, I think SEC questions and litigation are common because there's so much money at stake. And you have a situation here where it's so unconventional, it's sort of inevitable that the SEC is going to ask questions. If they're not asking questions, they're not doing their job. And I don't think we should read into it and assume that they're gonna find something debilitating to Elon Musk, but it's definitely going to be something that Tesla will have to deal with, that Elon will have to deal with.
And just quickly here in the last few 30 seconds or so, what's been the analyst or the stock price reaction? Originally on this news this morning, up 2%, but now we're a little bit paring back some of those gains. What's been sort of the reaction today?
Well, like you said, not much. And I think the reason is that if you were paying attention to Elon Musk over the last year or even longer, this is kind of what you figured. Elon makes his own reality. He's often very optimistic. And I think most people assumed that when he said funding secure, what he meant was something like this, that somebody important had said they would invest, but they hadn't necessarily like signed a term sheet. And that's kind of what we're getting.
And it's amazing just how this has all played out. And even the clarity from us didn't bring a whole lot of clarity to the market. Max Chafkin, features editor over at Bloomberg Businessweek, thank you so much. That's right. There are a lot of men at work in the Permian Basin. This is an amazing story that really shows the potentially unintended sociological and economic consequences. To hear more on this story, we have Rachel Adams Hurd, our energy reporter, joining us from our Houston Bureau. Rachel, great to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you find out about this, that these dorm-like compounds there in the Permian Basin?
So they're actually not new. They were up in the Bakken and North Dakota, still are actually, but in fewer numbers now. But these are really just popping up now more in the Permian because prices are back up and there are just so many people flocking out there to jump in on this boom.
And how many of them are there? I mean, if we were to go and look around, are there like hundreds of them just popping up?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. So some of them are independent developers and others are backed by these oil field service companies and operators. But there are thousands of workers out there. I mean, some of these facilities can already handle more than, 1,200 people per complex.
Well, and as you rightly point out, this is not new. And in fact, it's a throwback in a lot of ways. I mean, looking at the pictures, which are fantastic, and I would commend this story to anyone, you get this sense of, this is taking us back a century, it feels like, in terms of the way they're living, these sort of generally it's all dudes leaving their families at home to go work here. Is this just the way it's going to be? Is this temporary? What's the future here?
I mean, I think the communities would like to see these guys move out there permanently with their families. But a lot of them work, shifts that are 2 to 3 weeks long. So when they're not out in the field or behind the wheel of a truck, they want to be back home in Louisiana or other parts of Texas or, as far away as Maryland sometimes to be with their families.
When do we start to see some development come in that could be permanent, or who are the investment companies behind this that really could see maybe a long-term opportunity to really invest back in the community, especially if oil is planning to stay perhaps around that $70 barrel range where companies can be profitable?
Yeah, I think you're starting to see that in some of the cities like Midland and Odessa, but a lot of where this new activity is pretty far from places that have the infrastructure in place to be able to handle more permanent structures. So, while there is going to be some development that's longer term, I think for at least now, people really see these as the solution to handle the huge influx of workers you have.
So, Rachel, tell us what these places are like. Are they Spartan? Are they well appointed? What do they feel like?
I mean, they kind of feel like you're in a place where there are 80 single-wide trailer-looking buildings. It's pretty empty during the day because everyone's either out at job sites or sleeping if you're on the night shift. And then super early in the morning and late afternoon is when the F-150s start lining up to take people out to job sites.
And, yeah, give us a little bit more color, because I was reading through the article and it said alcohol is not allowed, but there's been a few disturbances and they're trying to put systems in place to make women, for example, feel safe. What is it like? I mean, I just can't imagine.
So I was was expecting it to be a little bit more rough and wild than it was. I talked to law enforcement out there, and they actually said that the man camps have fewer problems than some of the RV parks and even the hotels, just because they are so policed by the companies who kind of acknowledge that there is not this great reputation that they have. So they're really doing everything that they can to combat that so that the communities let them stay, because without them, you know, it would be really hard to find a spot for all these workers to live.
And so, you know, just sort of going back to where we started a little bit, Rachel, so, you know, where does it go from here? I mean, do these sort of fade away if the price of oil and all this activity starts to subside a bit? Or, you know, do we see something more permanent going on in terms of the sort of demographic economic shift?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sense that I got was optimism. You know, people are saying it's not like the last boom where all these companies just threw money at it and weren't able to operate in a lean way that would be able to carry them through a downturn. But at the same time, you know, a lot of them were burned last time, and they were laid off from their jobs and were just recently rehired. So I heard a lot of people say, like, we're saving money now because we know that eventually it'll go back down.
It is nothing if not a cyclical business. We've learned that the hard way over the years. Rachel Adams Heard, energy reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us from our Houston Borough. Fantastic story, fantastic reporting. Thanks so much. So, Taylor, you know, I have to say, you know, this is the sort of story that caught my attention, because we don't always know all the consequences of these little boomlets, right?
Right. Well, and what was really interesting to me in this story is they're talking about, we talked a lot about wage growth here and how unskilled wages, you know, can't get a boost down there. You can get $100,000 a year for unskilled labor.
For unskilled labor.
Part of that is they're having a hard time attracting people. So they're really having to offer money to get people to go down there and work. But $100K a year doesn't sound like too bad of a gig. And with markets on the move, you have sort of a risk-off trade today. Little fears over some contagion from Turkey and Argentina. Given all of this, it's a great time to speak with Dave Ellison. He's a portfolio manager over at Hennessy Funds. And Dave, you've won the prestigious award from Morningstar of being the most tenured portfolio manager. So lucky for us, you've seen a lot of days like today. And I just want to start with, when you sort of start to see some pullbacks like this, are these good opportunities to come in and buy the dip, or are you getting a little bit more defensive here?
Well, I think you have to, you know, anyway, good afternoon to both of you. I think the issue is sort of why it's happening. You know, if it seems to be a one-off, if it's company related, it's probably not as worrisome. But here you have a country now, and it sort of reminds me of what happened to Greece or Puerto Rico, where they, you know, the debt gets too high, people start to flee the country, liquidity dries up, the currency goes down or goes up, depending on which way you look at it, and the country now is sitting there unable to refinance its debt. And so, you know, what's going to happen the next 6 to 9 months? You know, it's not really about the leadership, it's about the debt levels and then what happens to the currency. So, you know, I think you're seeing a little bit of the impact of the liquidity being drawn out of the system, especially by the Fed. And you're seeing in the currency markets now, as opposed to, let's say, in the housing market that we had, let's say, back in 2008.
And so how much does the Fed here in the United States look at an issue like this? How much does it factor into what they're going to do for the balance of the year, in your estimation, Dave?
Well, we haven't heard much from them about it. You know, obviously they wouldn't talk today, but I mean, as things like this is going on, they didn't really say much about Puerto Rico. They really didn't say much about Greece, didn't react to it.
Yeah.
I think we have to always be mindful that we live in a country that is the reserve currency. And so that we don't have the same sense of how the world operates than these other countries do. And I think if you put yourself in a position of being in that country, let's say Turkey or Puerto Rico or Greece or whatever the next country is, it's a much different economic environment, because you do not have control of your currency, and therefore you don't have control of your prices or your interest rates. And so I think it's hard for some of us in this country to sort of understand what it's like to be in these countries,
right,
and operate a business. And so to sit there and say, well, the Fed's not going to react, I mean, maybe it will, maybe it won't, but it, historically it hasn't reacted to any of that stuff in the past, at least, you know, the last 6 or 8, you know, years. in terms of reacting to currency changes. So I don't think it's going to do that now.
Dave, I want to look at some of the individual stocks that you're holding. We see a lot of these that have just come out with earnings. One particularly that caught my eye was Zillow. Interestingly enough, we heard from the company last week, and they're off about 2% again today. Just concerns over their forecast and agreeing to buy a mortgage lender. We spoke with Steve Eisman of The Big Short, and that is a company that he's not very constructive on. I think he considered that as one he was shorting again.
Not very constructive. That's a very nice way of putting it.
You know, but then the CEO came out and said that he sees the company is growing and getting bigger and better. What is your take here on Zillow, and how have you had the courage to stick with them?
Well, Zillow, I think the story there is you're building a brand around looking for properties around the country and to some degree around the world, both residential. Obviously, it's a residential-based product now, but it's growing into these other products that are based on, you know, sort of looking at properties and looking at real estate just like, in a sense, you would research for stocks or bonds. And the idea is that's going to grow. And if you talk to any real estate person in the market, you know, people that are looking for houses don't go to the brokers anymore. They go to Zillow, look what the houses are worth, check out the pictures. I mean, it becomes a source of information. And so it's an information provider, which is typically what has a lot of value in this world. That's why you see names like MSCI, or those types of companies that provide information to the marketplace or to people have a lot of value. I think the problem now is that they've decided that they want to get into lending money. And that's a lower PE business. That's why Visa trades at, 30 times earnings, and Bank of America trades at 12, because one doesn't lend money and the other one does. And so from a PE perspective, lending of money is a much lower PE business than providing information to the marketplace, via this electronic platform. And so that's why I think the stock is down, and we have to let them, either figure that out or work that out for themselves.
And Dave, Taylor in her intro rightly alluded to your tenure doing this. You are, we should mention, a protege of none other than Peter Lynch, of course, the famed value investor. And one of the big holdings, sort of broader holdings you have across a number of names, is financial services in both the large cap and the small cap. Bank of America looks like an especially big holding. What's the value of the big financials right now?
Well, the value is that they basically have built balance sheets and income statements and corporate structures around a 30-year bull market in bonds that now is over. And so they need to restructure their balance sheets and restructure their entire business. And that's the opportunity. And in the meantime, they're making a tremendous amount of money, have a regulatory moat that the Fed has given them around Dodd-Frank and the stress test. And so the goal here over the next 5 to 10 to 15 years is to restructure the business around building a balance sheet and an income statement that lives or survives or lives by or thrives by rates that are flat to up. And I'm not saying that rates are going to go up a lot, but we're not going to have another 30-year bull market in bonds. And so I think the opportunity here is for them to continue to grow their profitability and reduce the risk of those earnings that they have. And so, again, if they turn into a Visa-type earning stream in the next 10 years, the multiple will probably double on the stock. And if earnings grow at all, you've got a pretty good story on your hands. And along the way, you've got buybacks and dividends. So, and they've got, the biggest market share in the business, and they have a great deposit franchise. So there's not a tremendous amount of things that can go wrong from here, except, for them not executing.
Yeah.
Because I think, that's sort of the bigger story.
Got it.
It's a get-rich-slowly story.
There you go. All right. Well, Dave Ellison, thanks so much. Senior Vice President and Portfolio Manager at Hennessy Funds, joining us on the phone from Boston. Dow down about a third of a percentage point. S&P down about the same. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. you need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Real estate. That's where we're going. We're joined today by Steve Brown. He's Senior Portfolio Manager at American Century Investments. And what's great is because he's joining us here in studio, we get to talk all things REITs. My first sort of broad macro question is always about liquidity, because REITs are known for being fairly liquid. But as we've seen some of the headlines and the tensions in the news recently with concerns more overseas than here in the U.S., I just wonder, how's liquidity right now?
Well, in the REIT market, liquidity is very good. I mean, in terms of the shares trading, there's a lot of liquidity in them. And then in terms of access to capital, which is probably what you're really going after, is the debt capital markets are wide open for commercial real estate in the U.S. So in terms of access to credit, access to debt, REITs and U.S. real estate are in a good spot in terms of excellent liquidity.
And so when you think about real estate, one of the places that would scare a lot of people away, it feels like, is shopping malls. And yet...
Yes, we
that's something that maybe you're a little more optimistic about.
That's a good question. The retail in general has had a tough run, retail REITs, over the last 24 months or so. We've increased our weighting in some of the Class A malls in the portfolio, such as Simon Property Group and Taubman Centers. And when I say Class A malls, these are the kind of malls that do $800-$900 a foot. Here we are based in New York, and for instance, Taubman Centers owns the Short Hills Mall in New Jersey, probably does $1,000 a foot. Simon owns both Roosevelt Field and Garden City, Long Island, as well as the Westchester Mall. Those, so when you think of A malls, you're thinking of a mall anchored by Nordstrom's, Neiman Marcus, Macy's, and then having a lot of good inline tenants, including a Warby Parker and a good food and dining component. So they're seeing rent growth. They're seeing sales growth of 4 or 5% this year. And they're seeing the same store NOI growth of 2, 3, 4%. So the A malls are certainly surviving and frankly thriving. And frankly, the stocks of retailers have done well, too.
And I got to ask you about that a little more. Why? Like, why amid the retail apocalypse are these guys doing okay?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is the retailers, which really took it on the chin, too, have really upped their e-commerce platforms, so they're doing better. And secondly, they've they have closed a lot of stores. They've closed the stores where they weren't making any money in, and that's basically in the B and the C malls.
Got it.
And then they've improved, and they have leaner inventories this year, so you may or may not have noticed, but there's been a little bit less discounting when you go to the stores. So that's the retailers. And then in terms of the REITs or the mall REITs that I mentioned, they've been selling their weaker assets and reinvesting in the stronger ones, either bringing in more offerings or bringing in hotels and apartments to the properties. And we've seen a major bifurcation in terms of the owners of Class A malls, where you're seeing rents and NOI go up, whereas the B and C malls are seeing rents and occupancies go down, and a lot of those properties are being given back to the lenders.
I wonder, too, when we look at shopping malls, if any of this plays into your world, where I'm seeing a lot of shopping malls sort of redefine themselves. Instead of just being a retail store, they're trying to bring in a movie theater or a restaurant or a rock climbing wall or a gym just to get people to come back. Does that have any impact, sort of the diversification that they're making? Is that helping to boost sort of the shopping mall REITs as well?
Yes. What they're doing is a lot of the A malls that I just mentioned, they've bought back Sears department stores. Mm. Sears has been doing poorly, and they've been the malls, the Class A malls, have been paying money to get the Sears stores back and reconfiguring them into something that's more relevant for retail today. So they have the financial strength to do that, whether that's a Zara or an H&M, whether that's a movie theater, whether that's a food court or a food hall. They're using it for different purposes. And because the tenant demand is strong in those markets we talked about, that they've been able to do that profitably.
So let's talk apartments. Who do you like there in terms of that segment of the residential REIT area?
Okay. It's been a very interesting and good area for this year. We own a couple different names in what we call the residential sector. One is Sun Communities, which owns manufactured housing properties throughout the U.S. Mm. The stock's up about 8% year to date. And it's doing well because middle America is doing well in terms of job growth, income growth. Another name we own is called American Homes for Rent. It's part of residential. They own single-family rentals. They own homes. They rent them out. As you probably know, home prices in the U.S. are up 5 or 6% this year. And rent growth, the ability to raise rents in these assets, which are homes for rent, has been about 3 or 4%, so much better than inflation. And then in terms of a bread-and-butter apartment company, we also own UDR. They have a nationwide portfolio of apartments, but heavily concentrated on the coasts. And again, they're seeing rent growth that's superior to inflation. So it's been a good story, and all those kind of names have been working this year. REITs aren't doing gangbusters. They're up about 1.5%, 2%, but these names are up 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%, so quite decent.
Steve Brown, Senior Portfolio Manager, American Century Investments. You guys have about $170 billion under management, joining us here in our Bloomberg 1130 studio in New York. Taylor, always interesting to hear an optimistic real estate story.
Yeah, especially when it comes to real estate and the housing market. We've talked a lot about rising rates and any potential impact that may have. But he mentioned middle America home prices are still rising. So often, Jason, as you know, we're focused here on the Northeast, but there is another big world out there. And we didn't even get to his data storage REIT, which I'm just wondering, big data's in, so that REIT has to be doing
absolutely
well.
Have to come back to that. Looking at the markets right now, all the averages off slightly, a little bit of the red. We'll get more to that as we get closer to the close. I'm Jason Kelly alongside Taylor Riggs.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
You're hearing all of our drive time music here. We're coming up into the market close just less than about 10 minutes or so. And what's great is we have Ed Keon here. He's the Chief Investment Strategist of QMA. That's Quantitative Management Associates. We know them because they're a subsidiary of Fame Shop coming out of Newark, New Jersey, PGIM. Really interesting. Ed, I want to start just on sort of a broad macro question, which I know we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of Lehman Brothers. We all heard about the quants. And I wonder, in 10 years, have the quants learned anything? Have they changed? Or are we sort of in for perhaps another repeat when the quants gave us a tough time?
Quants are always evolving. So our models change all the time, and a little bit at a time usually.
And when you have a what is probably a once-in-a-lifetime event with the 2008-2009 crisis, you want to be careful not to overreact and change everything so you're prepared for that particular event but not for other events. So you hope your models are sufficiently robust. You know, I think back to what we do today compared to what we did 10 years ago. I think we pay a lot more attention to credit spreads now, for example, as we started to during the crisis. Mm-hmm. So, but mostly I think it's an evolutionary change, not a revolutionary one.
So as you have written and said, I believe, tough not to be bullish right now. I mean, think about the earnings season we just came out of. People are feeling pretty good out there. How much does that worry a guy like you?
Well, we kind of get paid to worry.
Yeah.
So what could go wrong? And so we are bullish, but we're calling ourselves barely bullish. And so we're overweight stocks or overweight U.S. stocks in our global portfolios. But at the same time, we're not quite as aggressive as we were at the beginning of the year or even a year or two ago. And partially it's because some of the events that are underway right now, we just can't really handicap what the odds of a trade
like
war.
Like what? Yeah.
Well, trade war, and of course, most recently, the possibility of a global financial crisis. We don't think either of those two things is likely. But because we don't have a model that can really help us make that decision, it's hard to get so aggressive when you have potentially big things. You really don't know what the odds of them occurring or what damage could be done.
It's really interesting that you mentioned you're overweight in U.S. equity markets. We had a great chart out earlier today how the divergence between performance in the S&P 500 versus the MSCI ex-U.S., that spread is now its widest it's been going back since 2014. You had the S&P 500 up 6% with the MSCI ex-U.S. off about 5.8%. And from a valuation standpoint, those stocks are 25% undervalued relative to the S&P 500 on a P/E ratio.
That's right. When we started the year, that was why we're overweight non-U.S. stocks. It was basically a valuation call. But I think a couple of things have happened. One is you get that one idiosyncratic issue with the United States, which is the huge tax cut. So that made U.S. equities more attractive. And even though you might say that was discounted late last year, that seems to have persisted. Mm-hmm. And the size, and as you pointed out during earnings season, just the beats are coming in at an enormous pace. So I think that was one thing. And the second thing is, frankly, the U.S. safe haven status, which is somewhat ironic that in some cases the U.S. has caused some turmoil around the world, but that actually benefits us in the sense that that causes funds to flow into U.S. stocks and bonds.
Well, it feels like we had some evidence of that last Friday, right?
That's exactly right.
With Turkey doing Turkey aflame, essentially, at least economically, U.S. started to look pretty good.
That's right. So I think that safe haven aspect of U.S. Assets, but also you're getting strong growth out of both the U.S. economy and corporate earnings at the same time. And interest rates, although they're rising, are still modest. So, it's hard to be bearish under those circumstances, but I think it's right to be cautious.
I have to joke a little bit because we talk all the time about idiosyncratic risk. But if I keep hearing that things are idiosyncratic risks, you start to wonder if there is something more than that. Do you see anything on the horizon, if it would be a Turkey contagion or a China debt problem, that makes you nervous at all?
Well, we've been worrying about China so long that it almost seems like we have it's like the boy who called Wolf. You're getting tired of worrying about China. But if there is a aspect of the Turkey problems that could cause a global problem, it would probably work its way through China. I don't think that's likely, but that's possible. And then from a longer-term perspective, we think the market may be underestimating the risk of inflation next year. Not necessarily this year. But as we look ahead, we think there's a possibility that wages might start to rise rapidly.
Yeah.
That's great for workers. America needs a raise. But that could cause problems for the Fed, and it may be difficult to proceed along their same course and still manage to damp down inflation.
And just, Jason, quickly on that note, we had this story earlier where unskilled labor down in the Permian Basin, you now get $100,000 for.
Right. And so how much do you worry about the Fed getting it right now? We've only got about 20 seconds left.
I'm just thinking about taking one of those $100,000 jobs. The Fed has a really difficult job.
You've got to live in a man dorm, just so you know.
The really difficult job of the Fed is there's no playbook for going from zero interest rates. It never happened before in human history, or even negative interest rates. So it's hard to find a precedent. And so the Fed's going to have to make it up as they go along. I have great confidence in this Fed, but history tells us that most of the time things go too far.
Right.
Well, the good news is we're all making it up as we go along.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. Ed Keon, Chief Investment Strategist at QMA Quantitative Management Associates, based in Newark, New Jersey, but happily joining us this afternoon here in our Bloomberg 1130 studio in Manhattan. Thanks for being with us. All right. Well, we are getting closer and closer to the close. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ all down in the red. We'll see where we end up as we get a little bit closer to 4 p.m.
Thanks for listening to Coast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to the radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it. If you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.